March the 3rd, okay. Before the Health, Labor, and Commerce Committee today is the House Bill 741 and House Bill 703. And looking for expediency, and I thought that there'd probably be less comment on 741, and there's more people sign up on 703, and that at this time I thought would entertain comments on 741. The first person on the list, Mr. Dale Cheek.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dale Cheek. I'm the Director of Labor Standards and Safety now. This bill was before you because of some language changes in sections one and, all through it. That more clearly define who's covered and who is not. And we've added a section exempting owners or allowing owners to wire and plumb their buildings, own homes, and to increase fees for certificate of fitness to cover the cost of testing, verifying work experience, and processing permits. The first section now reads that a person may not perform, nor may a person employ another person to perform work covered by the plumbing, Uniform Plumbing Code and the National Electrical Code. Also, specifically calls for a valid certificate of fitness instead of the former wording of just a certificate of fitness. Nothing else in that. Want me to go on to each section, or do you have questions? The fee schedule under Section 2 will be for 3 years. Now, there's a $15 initial fee now for Certificate of Fitness. That's the first one. In the original application, we must test the person, verify his work experience, to assure that he has the required number of hours of experience in the trade. And our fee now in the state is the lowest in all of the states that we deal with, particularly in the West Coast. This $50 fee will include his first 3 years of annual fees. Section 3, we now charge $5 for the people who have the certificate of fitness each year, and it's now going to be changed to $15 for every 3 years. There's no increase there, but a lot less paperwork, and there is an imposition on the worker to keep track of when the certificate of fitness is due. Section 4 amends to take out rules and adopt regulations, language change. The Section 5 is the one allowing an individual to wire or plumb his own home. And Section 6 is repealing a grandfather clause that was adopted when the legislation was first enacted, and it allowed individuals with 1 year experience prior to 1973 to be grandfathered in. That's no longer needed, and it's almost virtually impossible at this stage to verify anyone. We have an occasional person come in, but very few, and it's always a very difficult matter to ascertain or whether or not they actually had the experience that far back, 10 years back, asking that that be repealed. We've had a very dramatic increase in the number of initial certificate of fitness applications. For example, in FY80, we were doing about 200 a year. FY81, it jumped up to 1,700. And we're going to do about 1,300, I think, this year. Big influx, lots of paperwork. These tests take about 4 hours. We monitor them, work verification, and that sort of thing. Basically, that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Chief. Is there any question from Mr. Randolph?
Dale, just on this $15 fee, even doing it every, it's certainly an improvement over it was, but when you consider everything that, you know, first I send them to write a check, and you have to process the check, I got a hunch it's going to hold, and the whole process ends up going to hold. Certainly, running $5 checks annually, it's costing more to process the
That's
check
right.
than it was to do it. I guess at best it's a break-even deal, even $15 every 3 years. Do you have any strong objection to not charging a fee? If it's costing money to do it, it seems silly to do it.
Well, if it wasn't for the fact that this unit is required to generate a portion of the budget from program receipts, in other words, approximately total budget is funded from inspections and certificate of fitness fees. A small portion of it is generated. So the unit needs the funding.
I guess my point is that if you need the funding to pay somebody to do something that you would need if you didn't have money in the first place.
I agree with your concept that every year we're certainly losing money at that rate. There's more of a chance of break even every 3 years than.
Well, I know my point is, though, if all we're doing is breaking even to employ somebody to sit there and shuffle the check, what's the point?
Mr. Hodges,
if I can try to answer the question, is that part of the cost of doing that is an external cost to this department. And in terms of this department, maybe. You know, okay, if they're bringing in $38,000 a year, maybe they have $15,000 in costs, and there's cost of the computer system, and there's cost in the Department of Administration. And if you wipe out the money for certificate of fitness, you wipe it all out of their agency. You end up putting a fiscal note then on the bill of some amount.
Mr. Chairman? Is it necessary to renew, though, that once they were issued, and you can cancel them for cause, what's the logic behind renewing them every, say, every 2 years? Is it a necessary thing to do?
We don't test them. It's to keep track of the, and to give individuals valid certificates, I suppose. The same reason for your operator's license.
Kevin. Would it do great damage to Bill if we precluded the necessity of renewing them every year?
I think we should have the record-keeping capability, Mr. Chairman, and to tell us who is employed in that area and that sort of thing.
Well, you, okay. Mr. Chairman,
sure.
Yeah, you offer the certificate, and you can cancel. So you got a certificate. If it hasn't been canceled, it's still there, right?
Well, under your theory, it would be, yeah. And now it expires at the end of the year.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Perkins. Mr. Black Perkins.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is Dwight Perkins. I'm business manager for the Plumbers and Pipefitters, Local Union 262 here in Juneau. In regards to the certificate of fitness required, I'm in concurrence with the person not being able to perform, nor a person employ another person to perform work. In the plumbing industry, I feel that it's important that everything is done to code. And without the state having the certificate of fitness test for the people applying and taking the test, the competency of the people just I don't think would be there. Also, to the fee, we're in concurrence with that fee, the $50, I don't think that's out of line at all. In fact, I don't feel there'd be, I wouldn't argue upping that a little bit if it were necessary to cover the cost of the state being able to give the tests, if it meant so. The annual renewal fee, I believe, also is something that every 3 years, a $15 fee, I believe that's a valid also, because the if a person leaves the area for some length of time, and the codes within that area might be a little bit different. According to the UPC, they in different areas of the country, and if they're adopting something a little bit different, I think, you know, it would help also offset the cost of, I think what I'm getting at is, if there's a surplus in the $15 fee, that could be used for helping fund a position, inspector's position, if there was any surplus there. I think Mr. Rogers was saying that, you know, if they didn't have it, then they'd have to take it from somewhere else, and that might come out of an inspector's position, which the state really needs. They are doing a good job, and I'd like to see them be able to continue it. And the last one of the Section 6 being repealed, I'd like to see that also.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions on membership? Thank you. Mr. Tom Cashin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a representative for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. We represent probably the majority of the people affected by this bill. We support the bill. We have no objection to the initial fee being raised to $50. We think the department's doing a good job at the present. We probably do a lot better when if they were funded a little better. So that's our position on it.
Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, I had a couple questions, Tom. One is, the existing law on electrical exempts employees of an electric utility which doesn't have more than 2,500 population. If you notice on page 1, lines 13 through
right.
16,
right.
Is there any reason we should exempt those employees? I mean, do we want utility employees to be fit, or don't we?
I don't know what the rationale is, Brian, for exempting them. Probably the just the hassle of the mechanics and licensing, flying people out to some place to give them an exam, or flying them in, or that was probably the reason for this exemption in the first place. But you're right, the electric utility employee. Should be as qualified in Kotzebue as he is in Ketchikan.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the reason, is the cost of doing business. Okay. Maybe Dale could give you some more background on it.
Mr. Chairman, that amendment came about in 1980, I believe. Some small electrical utility companies had some non-certified people without the required experience in line work. We cited them, and the end result was the amendment to the. We opposed it at that time because we felt that it was just as necessary for those people to be qualified as it was anyone else, and they can handle it. We found a couple of people handling a 7200 volt line that didn't know which was the hot line. Kevin, I think I remember the conversation in 80, and basically the utilities and the 2,500 population was an arbitrary figure, of course, but at some point you have to draw a line. I mean, there are people who contributed 20 or 30 people or 100 people. It's just totally not cost-effective to have somebody that expertise there and to get somebody that expertise out there. So at some point the line got drawn, and that's where it was.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my concern is that the way it's worded, if there were a utility that were in a borough that wasn't unified and didn't have a city within it, then it would be exempt. For example, if Golden Valley were to trade off a little bit of its the little corner of Fairbanks that it serves, it would, and to MUS, Golden Valley would be exempt from certificates of fitness. I think that's a defect in the law as it stands now. I don't know if that happens in other boroughs that aren't unified. I mean, that's, I'll move a moment later on that.
It could happen in Spinard, Alaska. They want to secede from Anchorage. Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, I have a question. I guess it's more for Dale, but I'll wait for anybody else.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Rogers again. Have I got the right? That's Sam's.
Sam's, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm also employed as a business representative from Local 1547 of the IBEW. As Tom pointed out, we represent a considerable number of these people that come under this act. I'm from the outside branch of the trade and maybe can give a little input with this utility problem that we have here, or that you're concerned with. I have had a little problem with that wording myself. Under the same kind of a situation, I think, that you were thinking of. And I haven't prepared any testimony about it because I thought it was something that the department had to have in there to work with that came out of this prior problem. We certainly wouldn't have any heartburn about tightening that up if you so see fit. I just wish to go on record as being in favor of this bill for a number of reasons, one of which is to help finance the department in their enactment of this thing. As Dwight pointed out, it's been working and seems to be a good program. We'd like to see the thing get self-supporting or whatever it takes to make it run in an efficient manner.
Any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Senator.
Sure.
We have one more person, F.F. Cameron? Cameron?
Cameron?
Yes, sir, Cameron.
My name is F.F. Cameron, and looking around, I may be the only person here that has a retail store. And I was only called at about 11 o'clock about this meeting, so I'm really not prepared. And I have no objection to the fee, Mr. Chairman, but I have voiced my opinion over and over again, and I'll repeat it here now, that I have the fitness card, and members in my shop are all legal, but in dealing with the public, every day, I can't give you an exact amount of people that come into my store to buy material. And it would do me harm to give you a list of these people's names because they do support me. But I would say about 19 out of every 20, and that's just off the top of my head figure, don't have fitness cards. People just don't have fitness cards. And we are repeatedly asked to show our fitness cards, and as recent as about last Thursday or Friday, and that's okay. I'm glad to see that because we are legal. But What bothers me is the 19 other people that are putting in plumbing and heating without a fitness card, sir. And regarding fitness cards, that's the situation we're up against. And to try to make a, I know there's another portion of this meeting coming up under specialty licensing. These people also have no specialty license. They also have no Alaska business license. So I'm talking about people who are very successful in competing against my business, or all people who are legally licensed businesses. So I don't know if what all we're going to discuss here today, but the fee, I have no complaint against. Apparently, I see the fee is $15 for 3 years. Is that right, sir?
Yes, sir. Very much.
But my other point is, it's really probably not the question, but you could charge $1,000 per person. What about the other 19 people out here that don't have a fitness card? That's my problem, and I'd like to see more stringent enforcement against those people. I know Mr. Markman is out checking up. It seems like he checks up on me, which is okay. But I'm right out there in front with my name all over everything, and I'd like to see him to get those people out in the backwoods who are plumbing and don't have a fitness card.
So you're really not against them. Bill, except that you feel that the idea is not being enforced.
Yes, sir.
That's the main thing.
Not being enforced enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Harry Plumbing or Jack Plumbing or Harbor Plumbing or Cameron Plumbing, they all have shops here in town and are quite visible. Their trucks are quite visible, and it's quite easy to check up on these people. I'm glad to see that, but I'd like to see all these people who are running around with unmarked vehicles, no Alaska license, no specialty license, no fitness card, and I'd like to see them get their knuckles wrapped.
Mr. Creek, would this help? This bill would help
yes,
in your enforcement efforts?
Yes, Chairman. We have five electrical inspectors. We have one position vacant in throughout the state. They're located in various locations. For example, I know we made over 2,000 inspections last year where we checked contractor licensing and along with our other inspection and some of the things that this witness is talking about. And I don't doubt that there are people out there doing work without certificate of fitness, but we're catching them every day and getting them legal. And I think the increase in certificate of fitness last year over the year before, it's 1,500 more than the year before, is a good indication that we've gotten enough people to do some of the work that we're getting there. I'll admit that a lot of those people are from outside, but we are getting more and more, and it's just a matter of time until, I'm sorry if inspectors keep bothering Mr. Cameron, they should recognize him by now, but we're trying.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know what these people are working on. Could they be working on their own home?
No, sir. I make out the ticket there in the shop to the charge slip, and they'll sometimes make the comment, put so-and-so's name on that ticket job number, the Smith job, or and this is Mr. John Doe picking this material up. He wants it specified to the job, so he makes sure he's charged out to the right person. So this is a job that has nothing to do with, he's doing the work for someone else, sir. Now these people are in every day picking up boxes and bags and truckloads of pipe and things. This is not, I'm not making the mistake that this is for their own home.
Mr. Randolph, leaving the system, you ought to turn them in. For a libertarian to say that?
I said, if you believe in the system, you ought to turn them in.
Well, you know, it's like, it's a long subject. If you see a car going down the highway 90 miles an hour, and a state trooper comes along and he nails them, pulls them over, and gets them a ticket.
and they have to pay the consequences. I'm all puzzled, you know. The plumbing goes in the house goes on the market and gets sold, and the person gets away with it scot-free, yet we all know the plumbing got in the house, sir. No one's writing this gentleman out a ticket who, this plumber, who put it in. There's no record of his license, of anything. I would like to see if we're going to come out with a law that have the, I know this is getting completely off the subject, but the person's specialty license number or the fitness card number on the building permit, or he doesn't get issued a building permit. And that is the way it is in a lot of states. Now, I've asked the borough this. They throw up their hands and they says, we don't want to be a policeman for housing or for the people who work on housing.
Mr. Rogers. Mr.
Chairman, as far as I'm concerned, that would be a matter for the local government to decide whether they want to put it in their building code or not have it in their building code. I mean, if they want to require it on the permit, there's no question the local government could do that.
But if I, getting back to the question, answer to that, if I was to turn everybody in, my business would drop off dramatically. They would go buy their stuff elsewhere, and I would have nothing more to do than to just go back and forth between the courts and the police and everything else, and I'd be a busy man, sir.
Understand the responsibilities.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cameron. Mr. Rogers.
I have a question for Mr. Cheek.
Oh, Mr. Cheek, okay. Thank you, sir.
I'm trying to read over the certificate of fitness is required for any work that's subject to the electrical code or the plumbing code. And I'm trying to read over the plumbing code. It says that the code applies to all new construction or alterations unless otherwise provided for. And then it says that nothing prohibits a person from performing plumbing work on his own property. The question I have, does the plumbing code apply to all buildings in the state then, or only those that are constructed by contractors, or only public buildings?
No, the plumbing code applies to all buildings except for the exemptions of in the areas under 2,500, I believe, in the plumbing code also.
No, there's no 2,500 in the plumbing code. That's only in the electrical code. But, so that applies to all dwellings, including owner-built?
Isn't there an exemption for owners?
Well, it says nothing prohibits a person from
performing. Yeah, we take that to be an exemption.
An exemption from the code. Okay. Essentially, the same thing appears in the electrical code. It says that you may inspect any place of employment or public structure, and then
that's correct.
So the electrical code only covers public structures or
multiple
or places of employment, but not individual
single
residents,
family dwellings.
Not single family dwellings. Okay. In that case, Mr. Chairman, I have a question on this exemption. The exemption section we've written into page 2 of the committee substitute says nothing prohibits a person from performing electrical or plumbing work if it's to code. And so essentially we're through a backdoor approach, we're saying that we may be putting the code on those people. So my feeling is we may want to just on page 2, line 3, after the word residence, put a period and eliminate the rest of the sentence and make it clear that we're not talking about work on people's by people on their own residences. I think that might be a little safer. I would hate to have this what we're trying to exempt inadvertently put them back in.
Yeah, especially in emergency situations. Mr. Bible.
Quick through with that, I want to go back to this renewal fee. What would happen if you didn't renew a license?
What would happen?
Anything?
Well, we wouldn't, if there were no renewal fees, if we...
No, what I'm talking about is, yeah, if there were no, you didn't have to renew, but give them their certificate, let's say for life, what's the difference?
I think that we'd have a lot more difficult time in ascertaining whether or not the individual had a current currently employed. I can't think of any other reasons that are valid except to be sure that the person is keeping up in the trade. I suppose.
But you don't test him again anyhow, so how do you know he's keeping up with the trade?
Well, if he comes back in for renewal, we feel pretty certain that he is. He wouldn't have any need to renew the certificate if he wasn't.
Except he may not even be working at that trade.
You That's don't true. Know. True.
It just seems to me like maybe there's a lot of bookkeeping for nothing.
Outside of the bureaucratic answer I gave you, I can't think of another good one.
How is that? Yeah. Honest business.
On that point, one day, I think that we're opening it up now, you know, pretty good for potentially safety as well as not being harassing those individuals that need to be certified. I kind of feel uncomfortable right now and for eternity, you know, letting it go, because there is a certain element of public protection and quality, as we heard yesterday in the consumer protection bill, that anyone and everyone getting into the business of building homes, and the public doesn't learn until after the fact that they've been misrepresented. Mr. Randolph.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the certificate can be canceled for cause, and I would submit to you that the renewal process has absolutely nothing to do with consumer protection at all. They send in the $5 and they get their $15, they get their renewal. They could have been out of business for 30 years and just keeping it current because they want to keep it current. They might want it to go back into it. And there's absolutely, has nothing to do with what you just said at all.
Wishful thinking about that.
Mr. Bosch?
No,
I think I agree with Representative Randolph, and it would seem to me, you know, if a person loses their certificate, you know, that they would be, if a person's out of the business for 10 years and wants to come back in, they still have their certificate, I suppose they're all right. I mean, there may be an argument for competency testing on some regular basis, but that's not what this bill is asking for, and as long as there's no test required for renewal, it seems to me that might save the department that much trouble.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly don't have a good argument unless somebody else does. I can't think of one. I've been trying here since I've been sitting here.
Judy, something different.
Mr. Chairman, I think a valid point has been raised here, and I think it's something that we have just never sat back and looked at from that perspective. You know, we look at this paper hassle we put people through, and so we looked at going to a 3-year sort of like a driver's license type thing. You know, why did we issue a driver's license for 3 years or 4 years and say expires on your birthday? If you renew within 30 days of your birthday, you don't take a test or anything else. I guess the same sort of logic or reasoning has applied here. But, you know, since the point has been raised, and since I've been reading plumbing codes and electrical codes recently, and you know the changes in what's allowable and what's not allowable, my recommendation would maybe that we go to like a 5-year certificate and possibly raise the fee to $75 or even $100, because we do know a lot of people are coming into the state just to getting their license in hopes and anticipation of coming back to work, maybe on the pipeline or whatever it might be. And basically we think a lot of the new certificates are people from the lower 48. But you know, you can have a 5-year certificate, and it just, at the end of the 5 years, you retest it. And with the changes that come about in the plumbing code, I think that would ensure some competency and some fact that they're up to date and they're still working in this field of work.
Mr. Randolph.
Yeah, that may or may not be something the legislature wants to do, but I think it's a much bigger question what we're talking about here today.
Mr. Rogers.
Mr. Chairman, in this committee and the legislature, as evidenced by the floor this morning, we've never shied away from taking on a bigger issue. just because we've got a smaller one before.
We've never shied away from talking about it.
You want an amendment?
he's got a pack of them.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to do any amending this bill?
Yes, I'd like to.
Okay, I would move that we strike the second sentence of starting on line 22, mm-hmm. starting with certificates, to line 24.
Okay, the motion been made by Representative Randolph, page 1, line 22, to delete sentence beginning with certificate and ending in parentheses on line 24 with $5. Any discussion on the question?
Question. What's the effect of that?
The effect is that there's no renewal of certificates.
That means the only people who have certificates would have them, and nobody new could get in?
No, they can get in. No. They can get in. They just don't have to go back and renew.
No,
they used to have to renew every year. This thing changes every 3 years. And the amendment would say that once they got a certificate, they've got it once it's been canceled. And it can be canceled for cause. Just eliminates a lot of unnecessary paper shuffling.
I think they're... maybe we ought to be considering in terms of renewal some continuing education requirements. So things do change. I mean, what are you talking about? Somebody's going to have a certificate for 40 years? Times may change in the next 40 years, and the fact that somebody was certified 40 years ago may not mean they know anything about what's going on. Now, go into a 40-year-old building and look how it was wired. Certainly wouldn't meet what we consider safe standards now. So I don't know how you could have a continuing education requirement unless you have some recertification or something, some way to check off on that.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Randall.
Yeah, I think that was the suggestion from the floor, and that's a different issue altogether what we're dealing with here now. I think if the committee wants to deal with that, I think it's a much broader question than what I was intended to deal with here. If you're going to get into the idea of continuing education, then that becomes a much more significant issue, much more controversial, I would guess. Which
is fine. Mr. Rogers?
Mr. Chairman, I support this amendment, but I think that putting a time limit on the validation of the certificate, and saying that a certificate is valid for 5 years from the date of issuance, would then mean at the end of the five-year period that an applicant would again, you'd have to apply again for a license. If you're a member, there are ways other than taking the exam all over that that you can get the license, either by it says upon investigation and examination by the department would then have the power to do a different examination for somebody who's had a license before, or verification by an Alaska-based labor union of a member's qualification to meet the requirements may be accepted in lieu of examination. So someone who's a current member of one of the unions could get it. So I'll support that amendment, but I believe that there should be a time limit and then a person come back for re-examination or recertification.
Mr.
Bob. Thank you. I'll support this amendment too, but I agree with him, and I also think we'd have to ask the department how much more of a load this is going to put on them if they have to re-examine in some way everybody that has a license.
Mr. Chairman, I said earlier that one of the reasons I could think of why we had a renewal was to sort of get a handle on who was still in the business. And that's the most valid point that I can bring up. We can handle by either by statute, if you the legislature wanted to do it, or by regulation, we could say that a person who's been employed for a period of time during that five-year period in the trade, and we would know that he's keeping up with the new codes and he's mm-hmm. and he's practicing his trade. We can make it very simple to the assertion of whether or not he was in the trade could be done very simply. It wouldn't have to be necessarily a written test again. We could do it by, it's very easy to do it for
union members, and for non-union members, we could do it the same way. I mean, it's a lot easier with the unions because they have a work history of the person, but we could do it the same way for non-union members. He could just tell us who he'd been employed by.
Mr. Rogers?
It could be a simple matter.
Ask unanimous consent for the adoption of Representative Randolph's amendment.
Object. Unanimous consent called for. Any objections?
You object.
The question is called for. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Opposed.
Mr. Gardner. Mr. Rogers.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that on page 1, line 22, after the cancel a certificate for cause, we insert a new sentence which says, would say, a certificate is valid for 5 years from the date of issuance.
Okay, the question, motion made is that a certificate is valid for 5 years after certification. Any discussion on the question? Mr. Randolph.
Yeah, I think I'm opposed without some pretty substantial testimony from the, both the industry and the department, because that's going to cause, I mean, that is a major departure from the status quo, and it's going to require, unless you do a lot of grandfathering in, an awful lot of constant, and I'm opposed to grandfathering in. I think what's good for one is good for the other. What you're talking about is, however complicated the procedure, in this case, the department chooses to
put it up, either complicated or simple. Major conceptual departure from what's been taking place not on this trade but most other trades in the state. And if the certificate does run out at the end of any given period of time, then the procedure, and we're leaving it wide open, whatever that procedure is going to be by the department, which I'm kind of opposed to, I think. It's just a very major issue that we have no information on the effect of at this point.
Mr. Rogers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the process would be then that after the effective date of the act, anyone whose certificate runs out, and right now they run out after the course of 12 months, would then have to come to the department, and in order to renew, to would then have to pay the initial fee again, the $50, for the next time through, and that would be good for the 5 year period, and they'd have to either take the exam or show that they've been employed. So I don't think any grandfathering would be necessary there. And I think that would ensure that those people who are practicing this trade are following the competencies. And I'm pleased that the department has the willingness to, you know, to try to make sure that all employees, regardless of their union affiliation or non-affiliation, would be treated essentially equally under it. And I think it's a way of maintaining what the whole purpose of this certificate of fitness is in the first place. The thing I think that convinced me was Representative Gardner's note of, someone built a house according to electrical codes of 30 years ago, they're so substantially different, and the existing thing does nothing but bar you the first time. From then on, there's no change.
Mr. Randall.
Yeah, anyone who's still functioning in any trade is certainly not doing it with the way they were 30 years ago. They've caught on step by step as they went along. I do think, and we might ask Mr. Cheek, but I think that the amendment would leave it wide open for the department to require anything from very little of it, as you indicated, to a full-blown retestment. Is that?
Yep.
That it would. True. And my only point is, I'm not sure. In fact, I'm sure I don't want to. I'm not sure the legislature wants to make that major step without more information, which is none at this point that we have on the subject here.
Mr. Baldwin and then Mr. Rogers.
I think I have to agree with Mr. Rogers. You know, if we left it the way it is, we could leave it. And anybody that was certified 30 years ago could suddenly decide they wanted to do some, and without any, they have a certificate, which certainly doesn't fit what this whole law is meant for. They aren't fit, but their certificate says they are. And I think that's what we have to address here, and I think that's the best approach.
Mr. Rogers?
I'll pass.
Passes to...
Yeah, I'll just make the point that the amendment that just passed did not in fact change the policy that's been going on as far as testing us with anything. That is the policy that the procedure's been taking place for every case of hazard. That did not change that. All the amendment just passed did is do away with a bunch of unnecessary paperwork. This current amendment does in fact change in a very substantial way the practice that's been going last since day one.
Comment I have, and I work in the peripheral field as medical doctors, and it's amazing some doctors that haven't been back to medical school for 30 years, and I'm astonished at what they try to do with patients. You know, if they were reviewed every other 5 years, we'd probably have a much lower death rate at the doctor's office.
No, what more do you think?
The question is then to accept the motion of Representative Ives extending a certificate for every 5 years, basically. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
Opposed.
One opposed. Thank you. The amendment does pass. Representative Ives.
Mr. Chairman, I'd have another amendment on page 2, line 3. Delete all the rest of that sentence after the word resident.
That's unanimous consent.
Okay, unanimous consent is called for to delete for Representative Rogers' motion. In line 3, after the word resident, place a period and delete all following words and numbers up to line 5.
Meet this requirement for zone residents. Where does that leave us, or in terms of whether it's still subject to any code requirements?
Mr. Rogers.
Mr. Chairman, this would leave it up to the local government the way it is now. If the local government has a code, it still would be subject to the code. If it doesn't, it wouldn't be. My concern was that this might have accidentally put people under a state code, which I don't think would be intended.
Especially in emergency cases.
Yeah, so if the city has a code, it'd still be covered. If the borough has a code, it'd still be covered. If their borough has no code, it wouldn't be covered.
Why don't you think it should meet any state electrical code?
For a private dwelling, the intent of the law has been that it not have to meet it, and I don't believe that we want to put the state in the business of enforcing a statewide electrical or plumbing code on private residences. I think that's the job of local government. If they want to do it, those areas where the local government doesn't want to do it, I don't see any reason to have one.
We have a lot of areas with no local government.
Mm-hmm. By their choice.
And it's those people who can't afford to live by a code because they don't know it on an emergency basis. They do what they can.
I think the problem is a lot of people do their own work, and they would do it right if somebody told them. And one of the functions that inspectors perform is just telling people how to do it right. And I know when I built my house, I wanted to do it right. Mm-hmm. So I asked somebody I knew how would know how to do it right. If I had not bothered to do that, I would have just done things out of ignorance, not out of... And now I'm selling my house and somebody would have got it, and who knows what's inside the walls. And I could have subjected somebody to a lot of danger, but it was more of a, you know, would have been more in the area of assistance to me in trying to do the thing properly. I just didn't want to have to, I wanted to build it myself. I couldn't afford to hire somebody to do it. Didn't want to spend the money to do that, but that doesn't mean that I shouldn't do it right, because the truth is everybody ends up selling their house. There are very few people who own a home that they build for the next 30 years. The average mortgage rolls over 7 years. So it does mean that people who build their own homes end up selling them to other people. So it does become subject people to dangers beyond just the argument, well, if somebody wants to be a danger to themselves, let them go ahead. But in reality, it ends up being a danger to the next person who buys it, who has no idea what's inside the walls.
Mr. Hines, both of them, Mr. Lattes.
I think, you know, you did ask people who you thought knew what they were doing, how to do it, right? You can check and see if everyone had a certificate of fitness.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The person was a journeyman electrician, so.
Mr. Lattes.
He worked on state projects, so I assumed he was.
Mr. Chairman, the
But I'm saying, in my area, there was, the borough has no inspector, so I couldn't ask the inspector, and the city inspector wouldn't come out. But if there had been somebody to inspect it, I would have had it inspected. Why not? You know, it was for my own benefit. I, you know, but there was nobody to inspect it.
Mr. Lodge.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that this section has an impact. You know, elsewhere it says, it already says some of this, except that elsewhere it says nothing prohibits a person from performing the work on a person's single family residence. Then here we're saying if it's performed in accordance with the standards. So that with the sort of double negative in there, that would mean that you need a certificate of fitness in order to do unfit work, but you don't need a certificate of fitness in order to do fit work if you're working on your own dwelling. I'm sure that's the intent. And once again, do we want to be enforcing, do we want to add enforcement of a state? I'm not sure that it would do that, leaving in, but do we want to enforce a state code on private dwellings in an area where the local government has chosen not to? Your point about transfer, I think, is an important one, and I think that people who buy owner-built homes should beware and should find out how it was built. When you said every 7 years mortgage turns over, most owner-built homes are not built are not mortgaged because it's so hard to get a mortgage on an owner-built. And my guess is, and I don't have the facts to back it up, but my guess is they're not transferred as often as most other homes.
Most of them, you can't find who built the home.
We have a bill for that.
Yeah. I mean, you don't know. I know in buying a couple of pieces of real estate, I wanted to find out who built them. And it was, you know, the only way I found out was small town, right? Find somebody who knew who so-and-so was, and then you don't know who actually built it.
Mr. Chairman, this line of discussion has opened up a whole lot of areas that are not people, where people are not protected, and I think we've got a major bill for that.
Call for the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right. All opposed?
Aye.
One opposed.
No, I'm sorry.
Unanimous.
Representative
Rogers.
One more amendment. Page 1, line 13. After work, delete the rest of that sentence. After work.
Good. The amendment made by Representative Rogers, page 1, line 13, to work. Put a period after work, and delete all following words and numbers up to and including line 16. Is there any discussion?
Object.
Mr. Randolph objects. Any discussion? Mr. Bosma, and then Mr. Randolph.
I think we're going into something that we don't know anything about. This was just passed a couple of years ago, I think. It needs a little further detail than is on the surface the way we're looking at it.
Mr. Randolph.
Yeah, I think the point that Mr. Rogers made about the possibility of it taking place in major population centers is valid, but this is going to leave out that far. There are a lot of situations in small villages all over the state where it would be extremely difficult, very cost non-effective to require the same kind of thing there. And I don't know where the break might be. A couple of 2 years ago, we decided that it ought to be $2,500. Maybe it can be worded better, but this amendment does not do the job.
Mr. Rogers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner reminds me of where the amendment came from. and that was from a senator from a rural district who was trying to help out his local utility so that they didn't have to hire fit employees. I see, you know, the number was totally may not have been totally arbitrary. It was big enough to exempt all of AVEC from the provisions, as well as the Kotzebue utility, I think, may be exempted by this, and maybe a couple of others. So, just because somebody managed to slip an amendment through 2 years ago doesn't mean we can unslip it this year.
we call for the question then. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed?
Aye. Aye.
Amendment fails. Mr. Lodges.
Let me try a different version of it then. It would be on page 1, line 15, after city, insert, comma, borough, comma.
After city, put comma, borough.
Comma.
Or unified in this county.
Yeah.
Okay. On line 15, motion made by Representative Rogers to put a comma after city, insert the word borough, and continue the sentence or unified.
I think I object to that also.
Discussion? Okay.
North Slope Borough. Mm-hmm. Borough would not be exempt from this now, I don't believe. But I think the population is probably 2,500 or better.
Maybe 3,600.
Whatever. But there's other small villages in that area that would not now be exempt. Is that an amendment? Same thing be true in Bristol Bay. Any of your rural,
none of them have any.
Any of your rural boroughs would now be covered with that. They are now exempt. So it does make a substantial difference in probably the heavier populated rural areas where this bill would in fact be, I think, not a reasonable expectation. There's a lot of those out there, 100, 150 people who have utilities. Lots of them.
Well, I'm not sure which way you're arguing.
I'm not against the amendment.
Why?
Sorry, I'm making myself clear.
You want the borough, anybody in the borough of that size to be required to have a certificate of fitness?
Mm-hmm.
Why the distinction between the city and the borough?
Well, I think the point is that, you know, government regulation has to have some degree of what do you want me to answer?
Go ahead.
Seems to me government regulation has to have some degree of sensibility of what the economics of the situation are, and what the reality of the situation are, and to force every small utility and all the villages of all the state to comply with this, I think is unreasonable.
Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, I'm Representative Gardner, just asked a side question. It's starting to get the sentence is a quadruple negative. A person may not perform without a valid certificate, except that may not be required if the utility does not have within its population more within its service more than 1,000.
Triple negative would be all right. Double negative you can't handle, but
no.
Triple negative gets it back.
But quadruple.
Wait a minute. The problem is that right now the city and unified municipality have an exemption, right?
Right.
Representative Rogers' amendment would extend that exemption to the boroughs. So you're arguing against yourself. You want these small people to be exempted.
I may be arguing against
Representative Rogers offered an amendment to do it. Maybe Mr. Rogers is doing what he doesn't want. And because Mr. Rogers proposed it, you're against it. But
he's usually available, or
you guys could trade places.
in consideration of all that confusion, I recommend we defeat the amendment.
Mr. Rogers. Oh, I thought you were. The only thing is, I see with the quadruple, a negative times a negative is a plus.
No, by saying it may not be required if they don't have that means it may be required if they do have any portion of a city or unified municipality. And so so Representative Randolph and I are correct that this would increase the areas that would be required to have certificates of fitness. And you're wrong.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I would change my recommendation. I would recommend that Representative Randolph vote against Representative Rogers' amendment.
Thank you, sir. Now that I know what to do, let's vote.
Question called for motion of Representative Rogers to insert the word borough after city, after the comma. Question?
Again, Mr. Chairman, Rogers. Without this amendment, it would be possible for particularly the Kenai Peninsula Borough and the Fairbanks mm-hmm. North Star Borough, for the utilities serving those areas to modify their service area slightly so as to become exempted from the whole certificate of fitness requirement.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, before we vote in rebuttal of that, they haven't done that, and if they do, I think the legislature should take a look at it.
Prevention is cheaper than
cure. Yeah.
Yeah, but two-edged sword, sir. Okay. We'll call for the question. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed?
Aye.
The amendment carries.
Jim.
Mr. Gardner.
I'd like to move an amendment change to 2,500 to 1,000 on line 16. I think 2,500 is a pretty substantial community and utility if you think of it, because usually if you've got a city, which is what we're talking about here, unified municipality, in most cases we're talking about a city, there are a lot of people living on the outskirts of the city. So in effect, the utility may be serving 5,000 people. And I suspect that's more the case that you're talking about in the community I live in. In fact, I think the city is around 7,000 people and the borough is 12 or 13,000. So, you know, but still it's the utility is owned by the city, it's servicing that. So the 2,500 is, I think, a misrepresentation of who's actually being served by the utility, because somebody doesn't establish another utility right outside the city line on the map. So this, I think, excludes more than just a few AVEC villages. There aren't that many city governments that are over 2,500 in the state. If you actually talk about cities, there's boroughs that are over, but not that many cities, because a lot of those people are actually outside the city boundaries.
Did you make the final motion?
Yes, my motion is to delete 2,500, insert 1,000.
Okay, on line 16, page 1, formal motion made by Representative Gardner to delete 2,500 and insert 1,000. Any discussion? Any no discussion? Question is called for. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
The amendment carries.
Well, just a second. I have a couple more amendments. But well, I think I have to do it.
Go ahead.
Well, just a second, because I'm not sure now that we're amended how this integrates. See, I was in
office. Years later, they have to come back. Retest it or anything else.
This may, sure. Should I have at ease for a second?
I may not offer.
One moment, we'll get some calls.
Chairman, can I see the bill?
Can you see the bill?
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Oh, I
thought you. I'm going to have to leave. I'm in the one I want to sign.
Oh, okay.
Do not pass unless amended. Do pass if amended. No rack.
Change that to 1,000. We tightened it, didn't we?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We loosened it for the borough. We tightened it back up.
No, we tightened it.
We provided for a great deal more than the regulation.
No, we required more than.
So any borough, if they serve a borough with a population of over 1,000, or a city with a population of over 1,000, or a unified municipality with a population of over 1,000, they don't require to have a certificate.
Not a borough, or a service area within a borough.
No. No, does not have within its service area, that is to say.
Oh, okay. Doesn't have.
Well, good. We'll start at 1,000.
Okay, that's all right.
It's no longer at 2,500.
The public
change. That's who we want for example. He'll change it when he gets it.
Take a chance at that.
The requirement that they show with a borough and 1,000, right? You've got everything.
Well, but Fergie's going to change it back and forth now. In order to.
Well, at least you see where we're coming from then.
But that'll hold AVEC in. Yeah. If there's 4,000, if AVEC, anybody from AVEC, if they serve any part of it. They borrow.
Then he'll come up with a bigger number.
Is he going to try to exempt any too?
Don't suggest.
Bill said these should be relatively simple ones. I said, yeah, but our community can do anything with a simple one.
Call for the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
The amendment carries. call the meeting back to orders and thank you for the break. Representative Gardner, and are you ready?
Chairman, I'd like to propose an amendment on line 22 on page 1 after the word cause, and language would read, or if the person fails to submit proof of attending 8 hours of continuing education code workshops approved by the department every 5 years. So in other words, for those person who is, quote, just being recertified, that during that 5 year period when he comes in to reapply, he would have to show that he has received some continuing education. This wouldn't mean that it's that the department has to provide that, could get it through his union or whatever source that he might want to, but it would be up to the individual to show that he has done that. And you know, basically I think this is something that ought to be required. There's a lot of professions. When you hire an electrician or a doctor or lawyer or anything else, you're paying a very high fee because, quote, this person has expertise. And if I'm paying for it, I want to know that they really do, not just that they got some certificate and they're in the business. I mean, I think a lot of people do keep up and do this now, and some people don't. But you don't know that when you're hiring and paying a fairly substantial rate for somebody who's in this profession, and you ought to be getting your money's worth. And I just think it makes a lot of sense for people to keep up, and 8 hours in 5 years isn't much of a requirement for a person who's holding himself out to be a professional in an area.
Mr. Rogers?
Chairman, I would hope that the department, in terms of coming up with its regulations for someone when they apply for the license the second time, would say, would require that. But I think what I heard Mr. Cheek say was that if they worked at all in the last 5 years, we'll issue them a new certificate. And I think that's not exactly, and I think that defeats the whole idea of having it valid for only 5 years. Kind of go back to the old system of automatic reissuance. If you've been working, and the only people that won't get reissued is somebody who moves away and isn't working. And my hope would be that by the section saying that we have adopted saying valid for 5 years, when they come back in, they've got to either take a test, show continuing education, and in terms of continuing education, the community colleges, some of them offer it. I know the unions have offered workshops for their employees. I know NECA has offered workshops for people on the new electrical codes and so on. And again, this is something I think the department could do by regulation, but since what I've heard is in the testimony from Mr. Cheek is that wouldn't be the case, I'm going to support the amendment.
I'm going to oppose the amendment. It's the duty of the department to see that these people are fit when they get there. And just to renew it doesn't sit. They're not, the department isn't saying they're fit if they just automatically renew it. So I think it's up to the department to see that they are fit, regardless of how they maintain their education or experience.
Mr. Chairman, the problem I see is that evidently the department is making an assumption that if a person has been working on the job, then that makes him qualified. And I don't think that's necessarily a valid assumption. I think probably a lot of people are qualified, but just because a person works, that doesn't mean that he's doing the right job. If he was working, we wouldn't, and that meant that he did the correct job, we wouldn't need inspectors to check up on him. But the reason you have inspectors is because people who are, quote, certified and qualified the job aren't doing the job correctly, both in terms of electrical contractors and the electricians that are working on the job. So I think we need to put some requirement. I say I think probably the people who are responsible are doing this kind of anything because they do want to keep up with their profession, but this would require everybody to have some minimal effort of keeping up with their industry.
I think that we're forgetting that we do have a Board of Electrical, Board of Plumbers, and so on, and that's where we get our continued education clauses in with professional groups there.
Mr. Chairman, the upgrading continuing of the code workshops, we put on, the department puts on upwards of 15 a year throughout the state every year, and we have for the past 2 years or so. And it's scheduled in areas where most everybody could get to. We could continue to do that and make it a part of the requirement. There are other places that one can get, I'm just sending somebody to one now outside to Seattle. I suppose we could expand on that. I hate to commit to the department with the kind of funding situation we're in now, but anything like that is possible, and we do put those workshops on.
Mr. Hodges.
Mr. Chairman, based on that, if the department would be considering it, since they will have to adopt regulations to carry out this bill, I think I'm going to change and vote against the amendment, hoping, I would certainly hope that the department would, you know, require continuing education to the extent possible in the regulations for someone who's getting a license for the second time.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Mr. Gardner.
Before the ship sinks altogether, I'll withdraw the amendment.
Mr. Hodges.
Mr. Chairman, seeing as how Representative Randolph has already signed Do Not Pass, I've got a couple of other bills of his I'd like to tack on to this.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move we report out committee substitute for House Bill 741, Labor and Commerce, with the as amended by the committee.
Thank you, Senator Rogers. The motion is before us to report out committee substitute for House Bill 741, Labor and Commerce, as amended. Any objections? Hearing no objection, the motion carries. Thank you all very much. I need discussion. I'll pass this one while we're getting ready for next bill before us is House Bill 703. And I see we have four people would like to give testimony. And Mr. Alan Bloom.
Mr. Chairman, Art Peterson from the Attorney General's office is here and has some technical observations on the structure of 703 that I think would be valuable if the committee brought those up first after Mr. Peterson's done with his comments.
Okay, fine. Mr. Peterson.
That's all right with me.
I don't know if we got copies from everyone with the Attorney General's opinion.
Come on up and visit.
Oh, no, I had the original. It just came up for the meeting. Does anyone have the Attorney General's three-page opinion? Okay, fine. Thank you. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Art Peterson, Assistant Attorney General. As the letter in your files indicates, your staff called and asked me for a position paper on this bill. The position of the Department of Law basically is that we support the bill, but it contains a number of legal problems, and we would like to address those. If you like, I'll just quickly go through my letter. The basic point of the bill, as we understand it, is the recognition of technological advances and to support those advances, the use of those advances in various kinds of agency and governmental hearings and meetings. We support that idea. That's fine. The thing that we do not know about is what the cost of this would be. While in some instances, if a member of the public is able to participate from a distance and not have to fly into Anchorage, for example, to attend a hearing, that's fine. It saves the individual a good deal of money. But if we are using those elaborate technological ideas, it's certainly going to cost the state some money. I cannot predict what the cost will be. In getting to specific provisions in the bill, Section 1 is probably unnecessary in terms of real need, but it expresses a good point, and it probably provides some helpful guidance. So I think Section 1 is fine as is. Section 2 presents some problems, first of which, when you recall that you're dealing in Section amending AS 4462-310, that's the basic open meeting law for the state, covering a great range of meetings, from the legislative type of meeting or hearing that they use in adopting administrative regulations to the administrative adjudication kind of hearing, which is virtually a court proceeding involving constitutional rights, to a general information gathering meeting or any other kind of a public hearing or meeting. So it has a broad scope. When you amend that provision then to say public attendance and participation at meetings may be by communications media, as the only amendment, you raise some questions. The first one I address in my letter is in some of the kinds of hearings or meetings you're talking about, it will be necessary for a person to be able to confront, to see, and cross-examine some witness against them. In that context, I'm talking about the administrative adjudication type of hearing. In other kinds of hearings or meetings, it would just be a matter of good policy, not necessarily constitutional right, for other participants in that hearing to be able to see. So your definition of communications media does not limit it to video type of media. In fact, it specifically says audio, video, or computer teleconferencing. That definition also leads off with the word includes. So this is not an exclusive definition. It means those particular things plus anything else. So if you're adding the plus anything else and the possibility of, say, audio, telephone, you are potentially causing some problems for individuals participating or the subject of meetings or hearings. The second point, since the communications media would include telephones, unless you make clear in the statute that the agency has the right to set some ground rules for the particular kind of meeting or hearing that it's involved in, you're raising the possibility of intrusion into a meeting by phone calls. As we all know, when the phone rings in our office, we have to answer it, usually. Most of it keeps on ringing and makes noise. So there's a possibility for intrusion. A simple amendment indicating that the agency could set the ground rules for its hearing would probably avoid that kind of problem. And the difficulty there is in connection with the last subsection of the open meeting statute, that subsection F, not being amended in your bill, but in the current law, it says that agency action taken contrary to 310
is invalid, or says void. If that's the case, and your amendment to 310 is interpreted as precluding an agency from setting that kind of limiting ground rule, then we've got a major problem, and the whole action of the agency might be held to
that. I don't see how it's any different from someone who gets up in the middle of a meeting and starts yelling and screaming. It doesn't say in here that you can set ground rules for a meeting at which all members are present. And it seems like that's inherent. If the existing, you're saying because we don't say that you can't make noise over the telephone, it might be invalid. Well, we don't say that you can't get up and yell and scream at this meeting. I mean, Mr. Bloom could get up screaming right now, and that's obviously against the rules. Well, if he were on Telelink and we're talking and got screaming, I don't see any difference.
Well, one difference is that the intrusion might be a perfectly innocent intrusion. If someone is given a phone number, here's how you can participate in this meeting, and they phone in. Now, I'm not talking about the carefully regulated ones where you're going to a particular place in 3 towns or 15 towns or whatever you're dealing with. But as the technology advances and your provision says that public participation and attendance may be by communications media, and the definition of that term is wide open, there's the possibility, unless you make clear that the agency can set these restrictions for quite innocent intrusion. I think clearly there is some responsibility in the agency and implied authority to regulate the conduct of the meeting. But when you talk about someone who's not there, isn't seeing what's going on, doesn't know exactly what's going on, they're given a number, they phone in, or they try to participate, and there are interruptions, intrusions. It seems that it would be better to deal with that right up front and make clear that the agency will be setting guidelines, perhaps in its notice of the meeting. It will be saying, here's how we're going to handle it. It would be something that would avoid confusion, avoid the possibility of intrusion, and avoid perhaps hard feelings in certain situations that could arise.
I don't think it's my major comment on this bill. So I just want to point out that there is a possibility of some difficulty on that. The third point regarding Section 2 is that when you mention only the public attendance and participation at meetings, you create a negative implication, and that is that the agency itself cannot conduct its meeting by communications media. And the Department of Law has written opinions in the past indicating that agencies could. And this is, of course, especially important when some emergency situation arises. If, after those opinions have been issued, you come along with an amendment that says, ah, we're dealing with communications problems, communications media for handling hearings, but we're only going to provide for the public's participation and attendance, by negative implication then, you're saying, yeah, but the agency itself can't do it. So I would suggest a simple amendment to make clear that agencies themselves can indeed use this sort of equipment. Going on to Section 3, the statement regarding broad dissemination of information is good, and we support that. However, again, you only mentioned for the convenience of the public. And this overlooks the legitimate need of government to get on with the government's business. Various segments of the public will often have different perceptions of convenience and their own necessity, their own interest, and so on. Those will often conflict. And it would be important for the agency to be clearly able to recognize its own need to view the public's interest as a whole and not simply talk about some convenience of the public. We have to deal with the public generally. In Section 4, and again, each of these amendments that I'm talking about would be a relatively simple one to add. I have not, at this point, come up with language for an amendment in each instance, however. In Section 4, you're now going from the regulations type of hearing dealt with in Section 1, past the general provisions in Section 2, to administrative adjudication. And speaking only of the mutual convenience of the parties is probably not sufficient when you, in fact, have constitutional rights involved. Convenience may be perceived by the agency in such a way as to restrict some of the constitutional rights of the individuals. I don't think that's your intent, and I think you could fairly neatly take care of that kind of concern with an amendment to the bill. The statute should not appear to give an agency the right to consider convenience of perhaps its own staff or some witness while disregarding the constitutional rights of the subject of a hearing. And I give an example in the letter of perhaps a license revocation proceeding where the witness would just soon call in from home and the agency might say, yeah, that's a good idea. And thus you prevent significant cross-examination by the person who is the licensee whose license is being revoked. In Section 5, the basic provision is okay, allowing voting by communications media, and already there's provision for allowing voting by mail. But what you don't cover, and of course the amendment says that the system has to show some record of who voted. It doesn't say how they voted, or should say how they voted as well. And as I mentioned parenthetically, not by what means, but on what side of the issue. And that's consistent with another existing statute. Again, to avoid any negative implication, you would want to, I think, cover the point here as well. And the last comment is regarding Section 6, which is a catch-all, saying that in addition to the open meetings law, the regulations-type hearing, and the administrative adjudication-type hearing, any other use of communications media is okay. Well, again, you want to make clear that it is not your intent to curtail any other rights an individual might have to confrontation, cross-examination, or whatever may be involved. And again, a simple amendment should be able to take care of that, such as something simply referring to any other use without infringing upon constitutional rights or something along those lines, just to convey the guidance that that kind of provision would do. So that's all I have on the bill. I would be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. First, I'd like to ask some of the suggestions that you had, a simple amendment here, simple amendment there. Did your letter, I didn't get a chance to read it in detail, but the simplest of that amendments that you suggested, are they available?
No, I have not prepared simple amendments. I didn't have time to do that.
Later on. Okay. Thank you. Is there any other questions from the membership? None at this time. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Vargas, what's
well,
your
it's not, actually, no, it's not the amendment. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Commissioner Nix was looking through the various departments. Some of them are saying it's going to cost us money for new equipment, and I think that the whole purpose is to save them. Maybe we may need to adjust the fiscal notes before we send them up to finance to point out that it's a travel saver.
Yeah, and that's a whole idea. I agree with you there. Mr. Bloom, or do you want to yield to Mr. Bloom? Not yet.
My turn now.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Alan Bloom, and I represent Telelink Communications as marketing associate and also in representing them before in matters before the legislature. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 703. I really don't need to read my letter to you. Basically, what we are looking for in having this legislation introduced and hopefully getting it considered by the full legislature this year is really permissive legislation to encourage the departments of the state of Alaska to move into what is a very definitely growing, burgeoning field of both enterprise and application. Communications technology is just growing at an incredibly massive rate. We're using it, we're buying an awful lot of the hardware. What we also need to do now is make the changes in the style of the operation of government that we're used to dealing with to take into account the direct applications, both in the public interest and, as Mr. Peterson has pointed out, in the government's overall interest and the efficiency. Attached to my basic testimony is a cost comparison that we have developed at Telelink just to break down the equivalent of teleconferencing costs versus people actually having a hop on a plane and spend a day in a meeting in Anchorage, just a round trip. And if you look at the figures, and this is numbers that that we're very confident are correct, for a two-hour travel meeting for eight people to travel from Juneau to Anchorage to get together would cost the state or cost businesses $6,816. For a two-hour teleconference meeting, that same meeting could be brought off for about $3,200, including your long-distance cost. There's a savings then in real dollars of $3,616.
Mr. Rogers. Mr. Chairman, actually it looks like it might be even more than that, because that assumes a separate telephone and CMX fee for each person, when normally two or three might be in Juneau at a single site, I would assume. So the savings could be even more than that.
That's indeed true. The format of eight participants in a conference is based on Bell Laboratories Human Factors Engineering. The average teleconference includes about eight locations. It may be spread nationwide, or it may be spread just to a very large metropolitan community. We've found that the teleconferences that we've run between Juneau, Anchorage, and other points around the state, often it will have two and three participants on just from Anchorage because of the inconvenience of weather and time of people leaving their office to go to another common meeting location. The points that Mr. Peterson has raised, in the main, we have no serious objections to. And in fact, we do agree. In developing the concept for 703, we were writing the basic approach permissively to encourage the state to use this, but not, in fact, binding them to the use of electronic medium. On the other hand, one thing that we would expect to see is each of the agencies in using this permissive approach will undoubtedly have to set some refined guidelines on the application of the program. We do anticipate that the amendments that we're proposing here would allow quasi-judicial rulemaking bodies to meet and deal by long distance, by teleconferencing medium. But in the case of license revocation or a route application for the Alaska Transportation Commission, it would be very much up to the commissioners and staff themselves to determine whether or not it would really be necessary and in the public's interest to call people in for a face-to-face meeting as opposed to, in fact, being able to use the audio or video or computer conferencing medium as a method for eliciting the appropriate information for a decision to be made. we would look forward to seeing Mr. Peterson's amendments. And again, I would say that Telelink doesn't have any difficulties with them, as long as they're not too much of a recomplication of what is a difficult process now in just dealing with the Administrative Procedure Act. Mr. Rogers has already made note of Commissioner Nix's comment in the position papers and fiscal notes that you have there, and I appreciate that, because one of the intents, of course, under Executive Order 50 is that the executive agencies of the state will use private vendors or private entities that are trying to provide some self-same services. We didn't see a need now for the agency to buy a lot of equipment in order to meet the objectives of this bill. In fact, where we are, where the other technology renders out in the state and tracks to deliver it, with the state probably would be one of the very financial systems. One track is all the sun of itself, and having an undue dependence on the place of works that we have to do. So, basic, just summarizing small comments.
We'll now, Mr. Peterson, to give a comment because his name is used on a certain particular thing, Mr. Peterson.
Just to avoid any confusion, I don't have any comments, I don't have any amendments
to offer. We were just called yesterday afternoon to get some quick comments together for a position paper to give to you, and that's what I've done. Now, if you'd like me to work with your staff or somebody in developing some amendments, I'd be happy to do so. But it was not my intention to go right back in the office and start writing amendments, and I don't have any at the moment. So
that's what I had assumed.
Whatever you wish, I'd be happy to work with.
Thanks to that.
Mr. Chairman, I think that the legislative legal staff is capable of working with our staff to develop this amendment.
I think that would be fine, because they can look at my memo, see the points we're concerned about. If you want to give me a call, sure, we'll have a good chat with them.
Thank you. I'll have it, Mr. Chairman. Any other comments from the commission?
This was prepared by Mr. Sokol, and I think most people realize that he hasn't been called out of the state on an emergency. However, most of those legal points have been addressed, and just in his letter, the basic overview, if there's anyone I think raised, for instance, and speaking of due process and those rights, it's pretty easy to recognize that the courts now allow videotaping. I look at drunk driving ones, but even on depositions and things like that it is already allowable. He has prepared just a very brief outline, and not having those before, but I think most of those legal points are addressed.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, would it be possible to get a copy of that?
Mr. Dover? Sure.